Hello, everyone. Producer Vanessa here. Welcome to this special edition of Tectonic. In this episode, we're bringing you a live executive panel discussion recorded at the May 2026 TSA Board Summit, where industry leaders gathered to examine one of the most significant shifts facing the technology industry today: how AI is transforming not just products and operations, but the fundamental business models companies depend on to compete, deliver value, and drive growth. Thomas Law, your usual podcast host, and George Humphrey, TSIA's SVP of Research, host this live executive panel featuring leaders from AptEdge, Certinia, HPE, Salesforce, ServiceNow, and Siemens. This conversation gives candid insights into the rise of forward-deployed engineers, AI agents, outcome-based delivery, customer value realization, and the operational challenges of navigating rapid industry transformation. Without further delay, here's our executive panel discussion from the 2026 TSIA Board Summit.
So we've got a Slido up here. So if you could take out your cell phone, this is how you're going to be able to submit questions to us. Go ahead and capture the QR code that's up on the screen. No question is out of bounds. Ask any question. We had a good therapy session this morning in the Cloud Advisory Board meeting. So hopefully you can feel free to ask questions and we'll share feelings with the group.
And we'll give people a second for the thing to kick in here. Here we go. All right. First question has come in. This is for you. Yeah. Are you ready? So, do you really think sales should report to services? And if so, would you be willing to change companies?
Let me read that question again. Do you really think sales should report to services? And if so, would you be willing to change companies?
So somebody wants you to come help
I know,
them.
I know. I really do believe it. And, you know, we were chatting about this earlier where we kind of had a mutual path to this kind of understanding, right? I was in sales for many years and I was at a company where just happened, when this was about 17, 18 years ago, just happened to have a bunch of big customers. And they're like, hey, we need somebody to go and manage these customers and manage them well. So I just jumped in and started managing these customers and renewing them and growing them. And many of them I had sold to. And I realized, oh my God, what have I done? And unless you can read this stuff in a book, you just have to actually experience the pain and go through these things. And many, many years later and other wars later, this is the realization I came to. So,
awesome. Perfect.
This came up in the Cloud Board of this meeting too. First of all, outstanding job this morning, and everything you guys talked about came up in the Cloud Board meeting. Because this one was pretty controversial. but what we actually said is, what would an AI native company do? How do they build their model? Does the traditional organization model still stand, or do we have to really fundamentally rethink the org? So I think that's what we're talking about.
Perfect. Another good question in here for Sherry. How does your model overlap with the Palantir model?
Well, that's a little bit of a leap, but in some ways, I can see where that's true, right? We did a very rapid prototype, right? We came in and we did an analysis of what they were looking for and what the data was that was coming in from an agent perspective. Remember, this is an agent experience that we drove, right? And we did bring in engineers and they did do a rapid prototyping, which we then validated. And then we iterated very quickly from there. So, I mean, our roadmap had a lifespan of 3 months, maybe? And if that, and at the end of the day, we iterated that roadmap very, very quickly based on the reality of what we deployed. So I think that might be what you're getting at. I wouldn't say we're quite at forward deployment and forward deployed engineer, but we were pretty close. We had some deep, deep people in our engineering and architecture department who were very, very engaged in the front line.
Awesome. I'm gonna jump the queue here. I have a question for you. I wanted to make sure we got out here, because you and I had spent time talking about the organizational structure model that you went through and that bringing of professional services and support. And I'm curious if you could just click in a little bit more to the benefits, because as you said on the stage and you told me, there was a lot of apprehension on the support side of the side of that bringing together. Right. But talk some more about to the benefits to the support people that you saw by bringing them closer together with professional services.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it, the goal really is to elevate the support motion from being something that is transactional, you know, get a case and resolve a case, to, you know, an entity that's really a driver of adoption, right? So clearly we have to respond to customer cases, but I mean, the new model that we're putting in place enables us to, at every one of those interactions, you know, document a high quality knowledge asset that ultimately gets republished, you know, in our support center and fuels, well, it enables customers to you know, self-answer their questions, right? Self-solve and get the answers that they need more quickly and drive more adoption. And as we move that capability and make it more automated, the next motion for us is to take the expertise that exists in those support engineers and provide it to customers through a, let's call it an advisory membership. And this is where you can have direct access to an expert, right, to be advised around the best practices to use these products, to deploy these products, you know, evolve these products, et cetera. So in essence, we're really in a motion to bring the support function closer to the customer and closer to, say, driving adoption, and let's call it ultimately driving more economic benefits for us as well.
Yep. Awesome.
I can't keep up with the questions coming in. They're great questions. So Fontini, I have one for you. How well connected are sales and post teams around value-based pricing?
I would say not on value-based pricing, because we saw it in the room, everybody said. But what we are aligned on at ServiceNow is, and you called it an ontology. So we have a catalog of all our outcomes for all our products that is shared across all teams at ServiceNow. So even in sales, they do the value promise, they leverage that catalog. But let's say they didn't do a value promise. The customer success teams have access to the same catalog and they start that conversation. So at least we have a common language. Now, the bridge between the two, we're still working on that.
Wow. Yeah. It's a journey, right?
Yeah, 100%. But just starting, and you said it, starting with the ontology, the outcomes that are based on your products, the ability to put telemetry on top of that, that we have. So now is, how do you build the experience on top of that to bridge the gap between sales and customer success?
Right on. Build a bridge.
So there's multiple questions coming in here around FDEs. And do you charge for them or not? And Kurt and I were in a discussion on that very topic in the executive advisory board. And one of the conclusions from that is, you know, the FTE models are evolving for sure. I mean, it's not like it is not a one size fits all when you use that term. But these are very specific questions of, are, if you have FDEs, are you charging for them? That's the question. So let's go down the line. We'll start with somebody who obviously has FDEs. And so are you charging for them?
No.
Okay.
Currently, we're not. But you're right, Thomas, that, you know, there is no one size fits all. So we made the decision that this is an important enough investment for us to make as a company for the future of the company and the future of the agentic platform that we have. So currently, we're not charging for FDEs. It's an investment.
So it's an investment. And then how about next in line here, FDEs? Sure. Yes. You have FDEs as a company?
As a company for us?
Yeah.
They're probably better. There are some folks from CSLV, who are the customer success team, who might be able to answer that. I don't think formally today, but okay. I would imagine definitely moving in that direction.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then ServiceNow, you have FDEs?
We have FDEs, and it depends, but in most cases, it's part of the offering.
Most cases, I'm sorry.
Most cases, it's free of charge. Very limited, though, right? We don't have it for everybody.
Okay, a little bit of a trend emerging here. Free of charge.
Same pattern. So it depends, yeah. But most of the time we include the service.
Include it, yes. And
it's the same, but can I add something here?
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, I think there is and Usman, you can correct me if I say this incorrectly, but, like, FDEs can be really valuable when you need to discover what the customer requirements are because the customer mm-hmm. doesn't know, and you need to tune an AI model. Mm-hmm. If you have, like I'll take CRM as an example, PSA as an example, ITSM as an example, when you have a defined product, you need to go implement, and there's a set of steps and a data migration and a configuration. Bringing in an FTE when there is a specific thing that needs to get done is less valuable use of resources, right? And so the key concept here that you need to keep in mind is FTEs are useful when I have almost an LLM, a low-code environment, where I really need to tune something mm-hmm. for a specific customer and get it working for them. But when I have a deterministic approach, I have to figure out how to accelerate the deterministic approach. So maybe move a 6-month project to a 6-week project, but that's not necessarily an FTE necessarily. It is just how do you accelerate implementation?
Perfect. And then do you guys have FTEs?
Yeah. I mean, you know, you said things change every 6 months, so yeah. maybe this changes, but our current belief system is we're not forming an FTE organization, mm-hmm. but we are forming an FTE engagement model, mm-hmm. right? So a way we can engage our clients if they are in this discovery phase, right? If we decide we want to co-develop products with them, then, you know, there's an engagement model around that. We can fill the FDE role from pre-sales or services or wherever the talent exists across the organization. And then, of course, depending on, you know, the expected outcome, we can choose to charge or not, right? So it's a motion we run and an engagement that we run more so than an organization or a role that we fulfill.
So I'm going to build on that, and I'll put a couple things on the table for the audience. First of all, Bo DiMuccio he's not the only researcher. Several researchers have put content in the portal on FDEs and what we're seeing there. So if you've not tapped into that content, I highly recommend it. Really good definitions and examples and all this kind of fun stuff on FDEs as it emerges. That's number one. Number two, based on the conversation we had in the board meeting, based on that right there, there's no doubt that there's a spectrum. This is not a one-size-fits-all. So I commit that on the TSI side, we will put together the following framing. Number one, sort of the different flavors of models from completely free to I bill every moment, and the different kind of responsibilities, sort of that sort of matrix framing so that you can look and determine what model makes sense to you. The other really powerful thought we heard this morning in the executive board meeting was the criteria to deploy FTE resources. It's sort of what you were chipping on around just the criteria for customers in general. But this is not, I mean, this, I've been in 4 conversations in the last 12 hours of people telling me of, yeah, I have sales teams that are like throwing in, quote, 4 or 6 FTEs, right? Because it's like, that's how I got the deal. But you know, the FDs get there and it's like the customer's not ready and what are they supposed to do and why is, you know, what are we accomplishing here? Definitely the wrong model. So a winning practice is to have crystal clear criteria about what customer types are you going to deploy them or not. So that criteria, what were best practices, we will also chip on this. Because, I mean, this is a very important topic and JB pulled after the executive board meeting. He's the man, like, as an industry, we could really F this up. I mean, this could cost us a lot of money if we get this wrong because these are super expensive resources. And if, you know, we condition customers that this is either always free or conditioned salespeople just throw it in, we got to get ahead of this as a service organization. So we'll keep putting meat on the bone there. But there's if you have questions about FDEs, you are not alone. Everybody has questions about what the right model is going
to
be.
Let me add a little bit to that too, is that the forward deploy engineer, it's a services motion with a sales result. That's really important to keep in mind because there is a high cost, like we're talking about. The average salary of a forward deployed engineer is $415,000. So they're very expensive resources. And today, for most companies, they sit inside services, which means if it's a service function, it hits gross margin. And so your CFO is going to hate that, especially if you're not charging for it. So there's a high risk of margin degradation. So you have to make the argument that is delivering a sales result better than a sales individual can deliver it. Lower cost with higher return, or not lower cost, lower time with higher return. There's a great paper that Mark Troyan wrote about this that has all the financial modeling that you need to go back and have the conversation with your CFO.
I love this question here because of its simplicity. And I think it speaks to the reality that, you know, everybody's in different places in terms of deploying AI. And the question is, can you, assuming anybody up here, provide a really specific use case where you used an agent? Just one use case. Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, so what I shared this morning, it's not actually deployed an agent. I would say it's deployed multiple agents within a framework, right? And so let's take the technical assistant that I talked about this morning that we had rolled out in January of this year. That technical assistant actually comes in and it can call multiple different agents within that framework. So we've got agents and we've got sub-agents. So I would actually say we've deployed, that would be a good example. All four of those use cases I talked about this morning actually can call one of the many agents within that framework. So that's a real use case.
Yeah. So we sort of like eat our own dog food or drink our own champagne. So we were customer zero of our own platform, and we launched the first agent within our customer service group. And we started with simple use cases like frequently asked questions, technical questions that were coming in with high frequency. And that was the use case that actually taught us a lot about replicating that with our customers as well. So we actually built that to now proactive outreach to customers as well. So I would say customer service was one starting point. And now we are also getting into SDR and BDR type of functionality where we are taking care of leads through our agents.
So agents for leads, agents for basic questions and support.
Yes.
They've deployed those. Almost everybody lit up here. So how about you? What, you have an example?
Yeah, well, we built a value agent. And what it does, it scans customers' telemetry because we have the ontology. And it gives a point of view on value realized on the existing investment. It also gives a point of view on the delta to be realized. And also provides a recommendation on next best action. So this is for internal use. Mm-hmm. Both our customer success teams and sales organization are leveraging this. And it is really to get the conversation started if you have access to no data. So we've been working on this for over a year, and we launched it in January. It's been a huge success. And so that's a specific use cases that drive efficiencies.
And when you say huge success, is it salespeople, service people? Who are you finding? All of the above. Who uses it the most?
Well, you know what? The people who use it, it's a split. We've looked at the usage data, but I'd say 60% are from the customer success organization.
Yeah.
Because they're the ones that typically need to go and defend, value realize, and optimize. But more so as we're, you know, the closed loop of sales, you can't go and upsell, especially in this AI world, if you haven't proved. We have 95% of our customers are existing customers. You can't pretend they don't have a platform. Mm-hmm. So you need to go in with a point of view on value that they've already realized on the platform. So we had to equip account teams with something. So we built a value agent. But again, it seems easy to say we built a value agent. We've been working 4 years on building this ontology, mm-hmm. and this data foundation that is mapped to our telemetry. This is what, and then AI came around and made it possible for us to have a UX to scale. But I think people don't want to talk about all the data layer and the ontology that was necessary because it's not fun to talk about.
Right, it's work. But I mean, I have to say, I am so bullish, and that's why I was curious who's using it on the use case that you described. It's something we call model-driven revenue. And we believe deeply that whether it's a service person or a salesperson, when they wake up in the morning, it's not going to be about sort of guessing, mm-hmm. what should I be doing with the customer, right? These agents are going to be basically saying, the intelligently informed, this is really the next opportunity or the next whatever. And that's a good thing. I mean, I think it's good for the sales and service people involved. It's good for the customer. And it's super powerful because the other thing, and even at TSIA, we do this, bringing together all these disparate information threads about what the hell is really going on with the customer and making it easy for your teams, your employees to have that and not be saying, like, guessing or I gotta make four phone calls or look at six different reports. It is super
The agent basically is really a customer-centric view on value, no matter where you sit on the organization. Mm-hmm. So what we're pushing with that is to say, whether you sit in sales, customer success, services, marketing, product, we have a lot of people in even our product organization that are leveraging it. You should be going to the customer and having that conversation. Hey, Mr. Customer, here's how much value you've realized with your with what you own with us today. Here's what you haven't unlocked, and here's how you can unlock more.
Yeah.
Which brings it to the services organization. And based on benchmarks and what we see other customers like you, here's the next step. And we've done that. So that's the same language, no matter where you sit in the organization, pushing that way of thinking. So yeah great use case, and AI made it possible.
Yeah, that's amazing. I can't leave you other folks out here. So you have a...
Yeah. I actually use an agent. However, the last mile of it, I don't use, but I'll explain why. So it's actually around telemetry. So if you were to visit our company's site, LinkedIn or so, we have some telemetry set up front. And what it will do is, for my personal profile, it will understand from those visitors, it will sort of ping certain telemetry engines and understand to identify where, who could it be, what kind of company. And we'll also find out, hey, this actually, the agent will then match against our ICP standards, because as you heard from the conversation this morning, we have very strict ICP standards. And it will qualify or disqualify with me the opportunity, and I can in thread challenge it. And I use this just in Slack. And once that's done, it will also kind of take an action from me to draft a message. So most of the time, a reach out message to those individuals or so has been already drafted and sitting and waiting for me. That's the part I don't use. Mm-hmm. So because I feel like it's impersonal to just send some random message. But in between also, it pings, depending on the company, it pings a context engine that we have to also hyper-contextualize things for that person that I would be reaching out to. But that I find very valuable, because even if I were to craft a message, because I don't like the automated ones, that context and everything that it gathers for me very, very quickly, and that it allows me to dig deeper and deeper as far as I want to go, is very helpful. I've actually not logged into a CRM in our company to make an update because of this agent as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just a multi-threaded conversation that I would have. And like, hey, now post everything to our CRM and it just takes care of it for me. So it's very, very helpful. It's my favorite thing. But that's one of the use cases.
Yeah, awesome. Perfect.
Thank you. So what's exciting for us is we just launched Veda, our AI solution roadmap. And so to give examples of agents that we now have our early access customers using, we have like a resourcing agent. So the whole goal is, you can go in and you can staff and somebody can use the UI, but how do we enable the automation of the staffing function? How do you come up with the reasoning layer that enables us to say, this is the right profile of the set of people who should work on this type of a project? This is the way skills are matching. So, and then like, how do you create automatic project success, project plan updates? You go click a button, it takes all the information that exists everywhere else, and it kind of comes up with a status update. So you don't need to go compile all this information or a customer success plan that is the same thing. You should have one at the start of a project. The other exciting thing in the way we are thinking about it is we've kind of looked at what we do, and we've identified like I would call 150 actions that are truly needed to make our product make us work. And you can now create your own composable agent. So you don't have to kind of take a pre-built agent, but you can use this and say, you can use a headless approach and say like, I'm going to compile groups of these together into an agent because this is what my customers need. And I can just take that information and go forward with it.
Yeah. Awesome. Kurt, no pressure here, man.
Fine. I mean, we have, I would say, multiple, you know, the standard kind of customer facing one at support center that helps you self solve or log a case for you. And, you know, we have an agent that allows a learner to express a desire to learn certain skills on our learning platform and guides them through that. But I think the one that is probably pretty cool here to talk about is, you know, our belief is we're going to be blending human and digital workforces together to create outcomes for customers. And so, you know, our business and services is fundamentally projects. And we've taken our project and we've built a standard work breakdown structure. What are the work streams and work packages and the associated deliverables and methods so that we can orchestrate that project prescriptively to get to outcome. And then, you know, projects is a team sport. You've got a project manager, you've got a solution architect, you got migration architects, you got implementers. And as they log into this portal, they engage agents. You have a project management assistant agent says, how can I help you today? And guide you through that project management work stream so that for once in our life, with the 3,000 professionals we have around the world from China to San Francisco, we really start doing things in the same way because, you know, every resource is being guided through those work streams, being coached on the deliverables and the best practices. And that holds true for the PM, you know, for the SA, which we really want to have a process-driven based solution design model. And, you know, we've got folks that have been doing it for a long time. And so this helps them make that transformation, right? So it's basically a platform that allows us to orchestrate project work, combining human and digital agents.
That's awesome. I have to just make a comment here. So was it 2 years ago in Orlando, we did our first conference, which had the AI theme?
Yep.
Was that 2 years ago, JB? I think it was two years ago. And I swear to God, this is true. I was talking to a couple members. We said, hey, we're doing this conference. It's all about what's going on with AI, you know, what's happened. And we were getting feedback, like, we're not really doing anything there. Like, we're not going to send anybody because it's like, we're just not, like, you know, we're not focused on that. And our executives aren't asking. And we were already sitting there going, that's like, cannot be the answer. And here we are 2 years later, and all of you just had these very powerful AI use cases that you had at the tip of your fingers that are real. That's not fantasy. That's in freaking 24 months. It's insane how fast this stuff is moving. Another good question, George. You want to pick one out?
Yeah, I'm going to pick one out. Let's go to Usman and Fontini. So do you have two separate sales orgs for services sales and license sales? So do you have those as separate entities or do you have one combined and why?
I can go first. Yeah, we do. So Salesforce is a very sales-driven company, and we have organized our company into these pillars we call operating units, which are sort of like mapped to industries. And those operating units are how everything else in the company gets mapped. So even the forward deployed engineering team kind of like shadows or mirrors the sales operating units. So ultimately, the licensed sales folks, we call them account directors, they do have a responsibility for driving services sales as well, but we have a separate sales team. And what we've realized is that as we have acquired a lot of companies and built a lot of products, that specialized sales actually works for us really well. So we have specialized sales and services is no different, but the licensed sales operating unit leaders actually carry a number within their quota. So they are responsible for making sure that they're helping drive that number as well.
Now, do you have a separate sales team for CRM licenses versus Agentforce?
So we do. So we have like anytime we have a new product, we tend to have like specialized sales teams for those. But ultimately, the we call them core account directors. They are the ones who are responsible for managing the full operating unit budget.
Okay.
A very similar model. We've also gone down being verticalized. So you have licenses sales is a group and divided by industry, and services is on another organization, but tied to the same industry. So they work hand in hand with the same group. Why? I don't know. I think we shifted. We did have a different model. We believe that right now that this is working really well. And the bridge is really people focusing in the same region or in the same vertical. So we're verticalized in Americas and EMEA and in APJ. We're not quite there yet, but it's at least divided by region.
So specialization requires a special approach. Got it.
Well, let's hear from the AI startup here. How do you, in terms of a sales structure, do you have separate, I have a technology salesperson and services or just sales?
It's, it actually, with the structure we talked about, it kind of solves itself. So no, we don't have separate organizations. Any service offering, because FDEs report to the CS organization and CS and both FDEs are quite forward in the sales process. If there is sort of services needed, that's usually executed by the CS team. at that time. And again, CS for us is revenue owning, so they're very commercially aware. And we also feel that at times, that's the better team to scope out what is required, set the right expectations and deliver, as opposed to the sales team that is basically qualifying the opportunity first, maybe the product scope there. And also what's great there is that the team who will be then selling the services will be also delivering it. And then we don't see any issues there from a salesperson over promising anything.
So, I think what's super interesting about the go-to-market sales models is that, you know, the legacy for sure, and you've been around a long time, like I have in PS. I mean, back in the day, you had a product sales team that couldn't spell services. And so all the service people would be pulling their hair out because the value is being given away, et cetera. So we stood up these specialized, you know, sales forces that would sell either PS or just sell all the services, could articulate the value, make sure we weren't giving it all away. And so we've had this model in place for quite a while for good reasons, mm-hmm. for good reasons. But in an AI world that is by definition what you're describing, way more service forward led, the whole entire customer engagement lifecycle, then what is the product salesperson quote doing in that world? I don't know. There's going to be a flip here.
Yeah. I mean, look, somebody asked me the question, and look, it's not like I'm against sales. Like somebody needs to wake up every day and think about how you win new customers in the business. But it's like at some point, I don't know if it was you, Fatini, was like, hey, what do you need sales actually? Because if this team is coming so forward and if it's technical and you're validating these things so deeply, I think you still do because it's not just the validating part, right, that sales does. Sales has to go out there, knock on a lot of doors, find a lot of opportunities.
Yep.
They're almost different muscles, yeah. I would say, and yeah. Better use them for what they're good at and not try to extend them beyond what they're designed for in that sense.
Yeah. Interesting. How about the last two?
I mean, I would think that it is erroneous to think that as a technology company, you don't need a sales organization, right? I mean, I think that sales are and going to remain incredibly, they can be difficult and all those things that you guys talk about, but they're incredibly important. And I would say we have dedicated service sellers, but they are complementary, mm-hmm. right? Because we're not in the business of services for the sake of services. We're in the business of services to unlock the value of the product. Mm-hmm. If you lead with the service to get to the product, or you lead with the product and you have the services, either way, they're entirely complementary. The goal is to get to an outcome. Mm-hmm. And an outcome is technology deployed, working, and the business benefits. And that deployment motion has a lot of complexity to it. And a commercial relationship ROI seller is not going to have the experiences and competence necessary to construct that project and contract it so that you get to the outcome. And here's what I know in 30 years of doing this thing is if you get a bad service contract, you're guaranteed to have a bad services project. Mm-hmm. Now, if you get a good services project, you have the opportunity to have a good services project. You're not actually convinced you're going to have one yet. But if you have a good contract and a good project manager, a good team, then you can get to a good outcome. And if you want to sell on outcomes, you're going to have to get it right on the front end. You're going to have to get it right on the front end. And that's going to take that competence of what is a project organization? What is it? What do you need to orchestrate to get to that outcome?
Which again, I mean, just to make sure, two capabilities there: the traditional product salesperson complemented by a service
hand
who really
hand
understands
together.
It.
Exactly.
So two.
Yep. And yeah. So I think Kurt said it really well, and I'm in complete agreement with him. But I kind of see it in the following way, right? Sales is essential to create the lead, to nurture the conversation, to understand the business problem, to qualify. Where the model is changing, if I need to discover the value with a customer, the customer is uncertain, the customer wants to see value very quickly, I will bring in FTEs. I will go into, it's more than a proof of concept because it's not just me coming in and showing you some glitzy demos. It is me showing you that there is value that you can unlock very quickly. And so services becomes an enabler of sales to enable turbocharging and getting to the outcome that we want. That's kind of what I'll call as the new model number one. And in that case, what you're doing is, you don't have what the service timeline is. You don't have what the service budget is. But the idea is you're going and discovering that and making those based on a certain kind of outcome within a defined period of time, right? Model number two is what we've always had, which is sales leads the way, But sales has no clue on what the service's length or duration is going to be, to Kurt's point. And so you just need to scope it out correctly. Right. And like the number of, like in my 2 or 3 months of being at Certinia, the number of conversations I've had where we had a bad services project and you end up dealing with the consequences of it 3 or 4 years later because there were customizations built in or the timeline was too short or the change wasn't done is kind of, I think, the consequences we live with. And that's where having the services team set the scope up correctly and make sure it gets to an outcome is really important.
So I want to do a quick poll for you folks, question here. The influence of services in the sales cycle in today's world, the current environment, you can either say it's the same, it's increasing, services is their influence, or it's decreasing. Those are your three choices, okay? So the role of services in the sales cycle, how would you rate it right now?
The role of services in sales.
In the sales cycle.
In the sales cycle. I think now it's significantly increasing.
Increasing?
Yep.
How about it? How about at HP? Yeah.
I would agree. I think it's increasing.
Increasing service now?
RFDEs sit in product. So I would say for now it's flat because the FDEs are sitting in product.
That's fair.
Yeah, I would say over the last few years, it's definitely increasing.
Increasing?
Yeah.
And
if I may add, there's it's also in terms of when you think about the lifetime value of the customer, and that's a more mature way of thinking about your revenue, I would say, then I think you are more... I think you'll deploy those resources earlier on with much more purpose than not as well.
I would say it's increasing, but it's counterintuitive in the following ways. Mm. The first is we are very focused on how to get projects from 6 months to 6 weeks. And we are very focused on how do we bring FTEs to get to value very quickly. So while the scope and increase in presence is increasing, we actually want to make services go faster, not slower.
Interesting. Now, if you don't say decreasing, it's going to be off-brand, but say whatever you want to say.
I would say, I feel like service has always been, at least in the companies that I work for, which is enterprise application software doing business process transformation, service has always been important, and it's getting more important.
You do see it.
Yeah, definitely increasing.
Interesting. Hey, George, I want to just grab this one for the education services folks in the
audience.
That's
funny. I was going to grab that same one. I'm looking at Janice, and she's going to come up and kick some ass if we don't ask.
Yeah, if we got to ask this one, and it's a great one, and, you know, because we're having all this conversation around outcomes, value realization, and outcome-based pricing. How do you see the role of education services in making sure that happens? What is just any commentary in terms of how you're viewing that capability as it relates to making sure the customer gets the outcomes?
Well, I mean, I have huge passion on this topic. So I feel like it breaks into two things. You're asking, how does it enable it? And then the question seems to imply, how is it monetized, right? So I'll try to take the first and maybe hit on the second. But to me, I mean, you can't get to a business outcome if the technology is not being used. Kind of as simple as that. Mm-hmm. And if your users, and we sell software that employees use, so if your users can't use the software, you're not going to get to the adoption, you're not going to get to the outcome. And so learning is absolutely instrumental, right, into ensuring that that happens. And not everyone needs to learn the same things around the product and the process. So you need a way to engage customers to deploy an enterprise learning program that matches role to definitive learning assets so they can learn just what they need to know to make that business transformation. Now, is it sold standalone or is it incorporated in a license sale? I think that's a debate you can have. There's good arguments to do either. We currently sell it sort of as a standalone offering, but we've given lots of consideration to potentially bundling it as an entitlement. Mm-hmm. It becomes a matter of connecting cost and revenue at some level, right? Because I've got all the cost, and if we bundle it, it's going to be recognized as software and not as services. And, you know, how is that going to work? But I mean, from the perspective of the criticality of it, I think it's as critical as it's ever been. I will say this, the education or learning services folks in the room are going to be under an immense pressure to innovate new ways of bringing that learning content to the user at that moment of need, mm-hmm. right? Because you're going to be competing with the product agent that can say, hey, let's go do these things and so forth. So it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out, but I think there's definitely a really important role in driving adoption.
Fantastic. Any other comments on that in terms of how you're viewing education?
Yeah, I think what we have realized is that, you know, well-educated customers or more educated customers are more successful. We have seen that, and they're also more profitable. So a few years ago, we launched this thing at Salesforce called the Customer Success Score, which essentially measures the health of a customer. And within that Customer Success Score, there's a pretty big component that measures the education level of the customer. Mm-hmm. So even if you think about like what's happening in this room right now, we consider this education, because if customers are attending our conferences and our events, they are basically getting more educated. So certainly we have both monetized and free education services. But overall, I do think that when we get more closer to outcomes, educated customers are going to have higher outcomes for sure. Because the other thing is also, you can think about services, FDEs, all of these teams that go in to help the customers. None of these teams stay with the customer perpetually, right? The only person or teams that stay with the customer perpetually is themselves. So you got to make sure that the customers can maintain that level of innovation and they can keep building on top of what we build for them. And I think that that's where the education piece becomes very important.
So for those of you who didn't see it, so Jim Broth came and did a keynote on that customer success score.
Yes.
When you guys had released it. And that video and a write-up of that is available on the TSI portal. And if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it, because basically what Jim unfolded there is they said, you know, we have a lot of scorecards like every company, but the scorecards are really about our success, right? We're worried about churn. We're worried about expansion. We're worried about how many tickets or whatever. And it's not really around the customer success. So it was about flipping that around and what are the things you look at. And, you know, the argument he made, which is obviously correct, is look, if the customer's technical environment is too, you know, dated, legacy, whatever, that's a problem. Like that's part of the score, right?
Yes.
If they're not well educated, if they're not going to course, that's going to be a problem. So they're, you know, those types of components. So it's a really good lens on thinking about customer success, really defining, can the customer be successful with our technology? So any other comments on education?
I was thinking that I think education services are really valuable and important for the technical layer that we engage with, because especially as we release a lot of headless applications, that's really important. However, with our businesses, for the end user, largely unnecessary anymore. Hmm. Because something, conversation I have with our engineering team is, if you need to train the customer on how to use our product, we've done something wrong. And I think, you know, and so we are making it to a point where it's so simple for the end user, where a lot of that education or, you know, how to get the best use is not so required, actually, because it's a conversational engagement. However, there are other layers where that becomes more important, because the ops technical layer, they need to understand mm-hmm. a much yeah. wider way of how we can use these tools and apply these tools, because the array of what's possible is pretty large.
Set. Yeah, I mean, I think this is what you were chipping on a little bit as well, is the fact that I think for education services, forever, you are optimized to help people use software. And the software has always been complex, no matter whether business user, you know, up to your, it's always been a pain in the ass to use. It's just, that's the reality. But now it's getting easier to what you're saying, you know, so there's that. And what you were on, agents talking to agents doing stuff where the person's not even in the loop. So it's going to be a different world for education services for sure.
Yeah, but I would say the world of training on features and functions is gone, obviously, right? I mean, that's mm-hmm. not what I'm talking about. But I think whether you need education is maybe somewhat related to the sophistication of the problem you're solving or the process you're enabling. So if you're supporting a PhD candidate to perform computational fluid dynamics on the next Mercedes class series, this is a pretty sophisticated problem, mm-hmm. right? And it's not about what buttons to pick, but it's about how to apply the physics associated with solving that problem. These are the kinds of, that's education. If you're in a an enterprise workflow and managing large, you know, multi, like million part BOM lines and you're building trucks, mm-hmm. how you manage that product structure, you know, is a process, right? It's not about the buttons that you pick and so forth. So I think we're, what I was aligning to is, or trying to drive is, we're not training on the product, we're training on the process and how to be an enabled process participant, or how to be an effective, you know, engineer and user.
Yeah. So that, I mean, that's a really powerful point back to, again, what's the relationship of education services to getting the business outcome? What you just described there was not classic product education.
Right.
You process.
It's exactly.
Like workflow. So, I mean, I think that's another good message for the education services. You're going to be more vertical. You have to really understand what the customer is trying
Completely.
To achieve from a workflow perspective, not just this is how you get the data in. This exactly. is how you add a record here. This is, yeah, it's a great point. You have another question?
Yeah, I want to geek out on this one a little bit. So agree that a strong product platform is the foundation. How many Palantir-like technical platforms will our end customers tolerate in their operating model? So if Palantir gets in there first, are you guys screwed? Or do you, like, how many actual of these advanced analytical platforms can be deployed? What do you think?
I think it's a great question. And because one of the things we already know is that we hear from our customers, what they want is just an API to pull data into their own platforms, right? So we're already in a situation where you've got competing support portals and you've got competing tools, sometimes out of the same company. So now we're talking about having competing multiple technical platforms in a customer environment. I would imagine they're going to get saturated at some point, right? So whoever gets there first, maybe they win. But otherwise, how do we start to apply what we already know from customers is just because you go build a castle doesn't mean that they're going to use. There's only room for so many castles, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Interesting. Other perspectives?
Yeah, I can share a comment. So I think this is a great question. And I don't really think that it's about the complexity of the platform that drives. It's really the need of the customer, right? So it's like, if you need a flu shot, you don't really need a neurosurgeon to come and give you a flu shot. A registered nurse can do it equally well, right? So I think if you think about like why Palantir became Palantir, their history is about servicing these really deep technical groups like the CIA and Secret Service that nobody was servicing, right? So they kind of like, you know, had to build this really complex platform. But I do think that there's a certain level of abstraction that's happening where no matter how complex the platform is, from an end user perspective, if you think about vibe coding, like it's not necessarily about going in and knowing different languages. It's about knowing how to use the platform. And I do think that it will continue to actually become easier and easier for end users and developers to use these platforms, no matter how complex they are, you know, from the foundation perspective.
Yep. I mean, to build on top of what Sherry and Usman said, right? Like the way I think about it is there's always been low-code platforms. Like Force.com is a great platform to build on top of. There's systems like OutSystems and Mendix. There is no Palantir. When you really decompose the Palantir platform, they have a user interface layer, a semantic layer, data connectors, and you kind of use that to achieve an outcome. So to me, like it's a little bit more of any product that's going to be an AI-native software company is going to have those components. And so it's a little bit of a false question to say how many platforms are going to be there, because every AI-native platform is going to have those elements. No, that is a... There'll be... very candidly, a real battleground between can I have a general purpose platform that has access to all the data, that has access to all the connectors, and can I build custom applications on top of it, and can I get to an outcome I want, versus can I have a specialized application, whether it's for chat, whether it's for project services, whether it's for other things, that can maybe get me to a better outcome there, and do I expose both, right? So that's going to be a battleground in the future. Selfishly, I believe that like it is all going to be outcome driven. If you can show that for the specific pieces you're coming in, you're secure, you can get to the outcomes you want and how you go after it, that's ultimately what's going to matter.
Yeah, I think so. I love all those answers. But if it is truly outcome driven and negotiated with the customer and they agree that's an outcome they want to achieve, then you've demonstrated you can deliver it, then that's the price they have to pay to get that particular outcome. So I think that's right.
There was a great question in here around AI and sales. So is anybody using AI to address sales white space, right? So going after net new customers, top line, not just, you know, productivity or of existing customers. Anybody have any interesting use cases there, leveraging AI for driving
I have one use case from the support perspective rather than maybe from the pure sales perspective. But one of the early implementations we did was a machine learning as a service implementation. And so as part of the that process, we have a program by where almost anybody, but including support call center teams, can get comped on new sales leads, right? So fairly standard. So what we did is we deployed an experience also, again, in their Service Cloud console that allowed that we actually, based on the customer they were talking to, the case history, their product history, we took data from that customer engagement and actually aligned that to our Hewlett-Packard Enterprise sales plays, right? So there are like 12 of them. And we would match real time while the agent was working with that particular customer recommendations for sales plays that they could go plug into our centralized database. So, and that was machine learning. Machine learning as a service. It was deployed actually in another console. And that's been relatively successful, right? It's generated millions of dollars. So,
and you said that that came up through support developed that use case.
Yeah, that came up through our team. So we're in customer experience and ops. We're not actually part of support, right? But in, again, in partnership with support, they're a big partner of ours. It became identified as an area we could help.
How about other folks?
I can add to that. So we have a similar application, actually. So we found that if you mine your support data, that's actually a really rich source of customers telling you what other solutions that they're looking for. Because they're regularly bumping into edges where the current offering, current scope is not meeting them. And as opposed to the support agent engineer saying, hey, you don't have this, turning it into a immediately actionable sales signal to the right place at the right time. So that we've seen generate some results. It's a bit of a newer use case for us. We are just deeply focused on resolution, but our customers have pushed us there saying like, hey, there's a lot of rich data here. Can you help get to it really quickly? And that's showing results.
Yeah. Interesting. Any other sales driven?
I mean, we have a really broad software portfolio, and so we have an AI agent, you know, that will reason over the customer's current, you know, what industry is the customer in? What do they have deployed? What is the next best thing to sell to that customer? Yeah. And inform the orchestrator that says, okay, based on this customer situation and their current status and history, the most likely success story for you to sell next is X, right? Which has proven to be pretty helpful.
Yeah. I'm curious, is anybody, because we're very bullish on the AI potential of AI for sales, true, you know, sales, net new logo, et cetera. And, you know, one of the things that we see is so powerful, and even what you're talking about, you have a product portfolio, you're bringing in all that information, but now it is super easy to bring in a lot of external information about those customers at the click of a button, their financial situation, you know, was there a big change in the industry? Was there a regulation change? All that can come in to inform, right? Plus, you know, your support information, like you bring it all in and then you have the models basically make a very intelligent assessment about what is anybody seeing that in play?
Yeah, well, we launched a sales AI coach to all of our sales organization, and that was the point. It's on Claude. Mm-hmm. It takes in data from across the organization and then on top of our sales process and includes our sales plays. Any seller can go in and ask any question relevant to their account and to a sales play, and it provides guidance. Mm-hmm. So it was launched in January, and what we're seeing is that, you know, salespeople that are leveraging it are better at closing some of the deals. Of course, it's not a
We got to pause and click into that, because that was my follow-up, because you said salespeople that are using it more productive, but that's like kind of a qualifier.
Versus the ones that are not.
Right. No.
The thing is that people typically the people who are, you know, I don't want to make this link, but people that are leaning into new ways of exploring pipeline and such are also the account executives that are usually better at their jobs, right? So it's I say that knowing that people that lean into new ways are typically the ones that are curious and good at their jobs. But back to the point of having a specific, you know, on top of Claude or on top of anything else, specific to your processes and your sales plays to help sellers is what we're considering the single point of entry now for our sales organization.
So our working thesis is that sales is the laggard on adopting these AI tools. And I don't know if that's what, if you guys are experiencing the same, that's what I was kind of trying to tease out there. It's like, you have a cool tool. But, and I interviewed the CEO of a company that had an AI tool that did competitive analysis. And I've told this story before, but it bears right here, because he said, you know, they had one of their earliest customers, thought they were a great customer, and the renewal came up and the CFO was going to boot him out. And CEO was completely confused. And so met with the CFO and said, like, why are you booting us out? And he said, because you have like 10% adoption rate in our salespeople, and I'm cutting things that we're not using. And the CEO of this company said, but look at the productivity of these sales. Look at the close rates of these salespeople that are using this analysis. And then the CFO said, well, shit, I got an adoption problem, right? And there was like a change of mentality, which is the right thought. But again, our working thesis is we're just seeing sales, even though I think there's some really powerful use cases, they're lagging a little bit there.
Well, we have Enterprise Claude, so everybody is using that. Right. So, and sales is going in. The difference is we're trying to build specific skills or agents that are specific to their job and to the processes that we have in our sales plays. But every account team that I meet is in Claude every day.
Yeah.
It's more about feeding them the right information, a bit like, the TSIA advisor.
Yeah.
We have a ServiceNow sales advisor.
Maybe one last point to add, like, I'm very bullish on AI for sales, but I think the tools don't work that well today because, like, there are certain simple things, like you said, next best action or like sales coach that helps make sure the salesperson is coming up to the average or like informed enough that they're not making mistakes. But I think the bar on sales is really increasing.
Yeah.
Because like if I put myself in the lens of a customer, they are inundated, right? Everybody, like you can use Anthropic to solve all your problems. You can work with Palantir. Every software company says like their AI solution is the best thing since sliced bread.
Sure.
And like you don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. And the bar for a salesperson is to be able to say, what is the specific issue this customer has? What is the specific issue this vertical has? How do I craft a story and a discussion that really hits home the issues they are wrestling with, and then get that to the next level. So the real value add to me comes in research. Mm-hmm. It is the ability to kind of really understand the customer problem deeply, and then to kind of take that to the next level. That's going to be the expectation.
Yeah.
And that is the biggest place where sales has gaps, because they may understand the features of the product. They may generally understand some things about the industry or other customers, and they may know how to read people and how to like get to the next conversation. Mm-hmm. But that research gap is where I see the biggest opportunity and where we're going to invest.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. George, I think time for one more, maybe.
I'm dying to get to this one. Okay. I think we could squeeze in one more. We got about 4 minutes left. So let's talk about future generations. So the next generation. What does a college career path look like to help scale for 4 deployed engineers? Now, are they not just unicorns? Can we make these, or are they just unicorns? And then I don't want to bias anybody, so I'll tell you what Palantir is doing. But you guys go ahead. Who wants to jump in on that?
I mean, I can start. I sit on the AI Council for the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth, and I'm working with the dean. We're actively redesigning, what does the courses look like for an MBA student? Where do we stay with the core curriculum? Where do we kind of bring in AI, and how do we think about it? So like, this is an active discussion across a lot of schools as they're thinking about it. What is very interesting to me about the forward deployed engineers is that it combines the ability to understand the domain knowledge very quickly and understand the customer problem with having the technology skills to be able to use the technology to solve the customer problem, right? And so the answer is, it doesn't come from one place. Mm-hmm. The answer is, it comes from a person who can cross both the technology and the business threshold. And that is kind of what you're looking for. So there could be like, as a part of the AI Council, we have a bunch of other companies. I remember, I think it was someone from Meta or somewhere else that was saying, they enforce kind of everybody to have an AI engagement score to use all the tools. It doesn't matter where you start. It's kind of what you learn. Mm-hmm. And so you could have a business person or a domain person who spends a lot of time with the tools, gets comfortable with the tools and can cross over to do it. Or you can have someone who's very technical but interested in the business and cross over. So you're looking for a mindset and a person who can cross both areas more than you're looking for, you know, it's this profile of this person that you want to go after.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah. I think the challenge in answering this question is that you're making an assumption that what you are teaching the kids today is going to still be the same 4 years from now. And I think in the AI context, that's just not true, right? We can see it, how things are changing. And I don't really think that FDEs are unicorns. Like, we have hired a lot of FDEs in the last 6 months. They are hard to find because it's a new emerging role, but they're certainly not unicorns. So I think there has been some misconceptions and hype around, like, even a year ago, everybody started saying software engineering is dead. I don't think software engineering is dead. I think kids should absolutely go to school for software engineering, because even if you think about vibe coding and the ability to write code without writing a single line of code, people who can understand how that code is written can actually generate much more effective code than people like who don't understand how to write code, right? So I do think that foundational knowledge is going to be needed. It's just that how you operate and how you interact with these systems in order to get to the final output, that will change. Yeah. So I do think that software engineering right now is a very strong field.
I'll something to add. I think if you're, because the question says, what does a college career path look like? I feel like you can almost study whatever you want in college, but if you're going to study something, maybe the technical path first. Nobody comes out of college understanding all this business acumen. You need to, you know, be in the fire to learn those things. So I also think in the FDE role, there'll be different layers. So I do think that you will be in the seat for a period of time and graduate to higher levels of operating and so on. So if you were to index on something, I think the technical foundation is really important, because, and some general business is important, but I think the true acumen comes in the field. Yeah. And that's where you really cut your teeth.
Yeah. Interesting.
Any other thoughts before I tell you what Palantir does? So Palantir thinks college is ruining kids. So what they're doing is sort of like the NFL, sometimes even in high school, seniors in high school that are high technical proficiency and good business sense, they're going in and poaching them, and they're pulling them out freshman year, sophomore year, and paying them about $120,000 to start, which is a steal. But then they make them, they build them in the image of what they are looking for.
You were going to tell it. You're a big believer.
Well, I mean, a big believer in intellectual horsepower. So if you get really, really smart people, you're going to need that high intellect, right? And then it's a technical professional with domain acumen and some consulting or professional skills, right? I mean, we've had various flavors of that kind of professional for years in our industry, quite honestly. And it starts with high intellect. And then after that, you know, you train them on some technology and you get them exposure into industry, right? And they're critical thinkers and motivated to solving problems, and they can network with others, because your knowledge is never as strong as the collective knowledge of everyone around you, and you can do amazing things, right? So I think it's an interesting problem. I feel like it's honestly overstated at some level.
Mm-hmm. Very on brand. Good. Well, I thank you very much, panel, for the discussion. I enjoyed it. I hope you folks enjoyed it as well. Thank you much for the day today. See you tomorrow.